spend the night away. Here they have a lot of fun, putting trouble on the run. Man, you find the old and young twisting the night away.
On December 11th, 1964, Sam Cooke, the singer and songwriter of some of the most recognizable soul and pop songs and civil rights anthems ever written, including Twisting the Night Away, You Send Me, Wonderful World, A Change Is Gonna Come, and so many more, was shot and killed in a Los Angeles motel. Sam Cooke's killing was perhaps the first modern true crime story involving the slaying of one of the most famous people of his era under circumstances that were shrouded in mystery and steeped in controversy. The night before he was killed, Sam Cooke ate dinner at Martoni's restaurant in Hollywood. Martoni's was the quintessential mid-century Italian place, a narrow room with red leather booths along one wall and a sprawling bar against the other, separated by a handful of tables. The restaurant was a hotspot, and music legends like George Harrison, Phil Spector, James Taylor, and Carly Simon ate there frequently. On this night, Cooke dined with Al Schmidt, his close friend and longtime producer, but Cooke would periodically get up to make the rounds to greet friends and fans. He was also proudly, and in hindsight, very naively, waving around a huge wad of cash, reportedly in the neighborhood of $5,000, around $50,000 in today's money, that he'd received for doing a couple LA concerts the last few nights. Among the people Cooke talked with that night was an attractive young woman sitting at the bar by herself by the name of Alyssa Boyer. When dinner ended, Cooke and Boyer talked at the bar for some time, and then decided to get in Cooke's Ferrari and drive to a Hollywood nightclub called PJ's, but they arrived just prior to closing and couldn't get in. They got back in the car and drove 15 miles south to a $3 per night motel in South LA called the Hacienda Hotel, where they checked in just after 2:30 in the morning. Cooke left Boyer in the car and went inside to request a room. He registered as Mr. and Mrs. Sam Cooke, abiding by a legal prohibition at the time forbidding unmarried men and women from sharing hotel rooms. The real Mrs. Cooke, a woman named Barbara Campbell, was back home in Chicago with the couple's two small children. The hotel manager, a woman named Bertha Franklin, gave Cooke the keys to one of the rooms, and he and Boyer made their way through the lobby, past the small bar, which still teemed with people despite the late hour, down the hall and inside the room. Witnesses in the hotel lobby said that a while after Boyer and Cooke went into the room, Boyer came back out in a hurry, dressed only in her underwear and carrying a heap of clothes under her arm. She sprinted to the motel office where Bertha Franklin was, knocked on the locked office door, and then looked back to see Cooke emerging from the room and fled. Seconds later, Cooke, naked except for a sports coat, came running after Boyer, screaming that she had robbed him. Cooke forced his way into the reception office, demanding to know where Boyer was. Franklin would later testify that Cooke, quote, grabbed both of my arms and started twisting them and asked me, where was that girl? I started kicking. I tried to bite him through the jacket. I was fighting, biting, scratching, everything. Franklin freed herself from Cook's grasp, grabbed her .22 caliber pistol, aimed it at Cooke, and squeezed off three shots. Two missed, but the third, fired from only a few inches away, struck Cooke in the middle of his chest and pierced his heart. Cooke dropped to his knees and, according to Franklin, wheezed, "Lady, you shot me." Franklin told police she dropped the gun, grabbed a broom propped up against a nearby wall, and struck Cooke on the head. He fell and died on the motel floor. Sam Cooke was 33 years old. I'm Jason Beckerman.
I'm Derek Kaufman.
This is Last Days, Sam Cooke.
In the aftermath of Sam Cooke's death, two competing narratives emerged about what exactly happened that night between Boyer and Cooke that ultimately led to his death. The first narrative, provided primarily by Boyer with some assistance from Bertha Franklin, painted Cooke as a predator who kidnapped and sexually assaulted the unassuming young woman. Boyer told police that Cooke drank heavily at Martoni's, but she remained sober. After they left in Cooke's Ferrari and subsequently were turned away from PJ's nightclub, she asked him to take her home, but Cooke refused, insisting they go for a ride to explore other sections of the city. They drove for about 20 minutes until Cooke pulled into the Hacienda Hotel parking lot. For what it's worth, the Hacienda was in South Los Angeles neighborhood known as Vermont Vista, which, though it has gentrified some in recent years alongside the development of SoFi Stadium and the LA Clippers' new arena short distances away, was in 1964 and remains today in a tough and crime-ridden part of town. Boyer told investigators she made it clear to Cooke when they arrived at the Hacienda she did not want to get a room with him, but that he nevertheless got out of the car and went into the hotel office. A few minutes later, he came back with a key and got Boyer from the car, at which point she again said she didn't feel comfortable. But, Boyer said, Cook was adamant, and she ultimately acceded to his wishes. Boyer said that once inside the room, Cook became aggressive, grabbed her, and pressed his body against hers, ignoring her pleas for him to stop. Cook allegedly yanked at Boyer's clothes, eventually managing to pull them off despite her objections. Boyer said she fought back against Cook and was able to escape his grasp and run into the bathroom where she locked herself in. A few minutes later, believing Cook was asleep, she came out of the bathroom and saw Cook naked on the bed. Boyer said she grabbed her clothes into her arms, opened the door, and fled. She ran down the corridor to the manager's office and pounded on the door, but when she turned back and saw an enraged Cook emerging from the room to come after her, she ran past the office and hid. It was then she realized that in her haste to grab her own clothes, that she'd also grabbed Cook's, so she ditched them under a stairway and called police to report that she'd been kidnapped and sexually assaulted. Cook, unable to find Boyer, burst into the office, setting up the confrontation with Bertha Franklin that led to Cook's death. Boyer and Franklin both testified that they had no idea what might have happened to the $5,000 Cook had been carrying with him earlier that night. The money was never found.
Most who knew the singer refused to accept the official story, and over the ensuing weeks and months, Cook's associates, as well as scores of journalists and others who have looked into the matter, uncovered new evidence from which an alternative narrative emerged, one that cast Cook as an unwitting victim to a scheming Boyer and Franklin. The first shoe to drop was the revelation that Boyer was a prostitute, and this was not her first time entertaining men at the Hacienda. This, coupled with the fact that Cook was not from LA and had likely never traveled to this part of town before, suggests that it was likely that Boyer, and not Cook, was the one to suggest the location for the rendezvous. Further, Bertha Franklin was not just a hotel manager, but an ex-madame with prior convictions for sex crimes. Franklin and Boyer denied knowing each other prior to the night of the incident, which, though possible, seems somewhat implausible in light of what we now know. Subsequent investigations focused on other elements of Boyer's and Franklin's stories that didn't seem to match up. Several diners at Martoni's who were interviewed in the days and weeks after the incident reported seeing Boyer drink heavily with Cook and happily walk arm-in-arm with him out of the restaurant, betraying her story that she remained sober and only reluctantly left with Cook. Moreover, the autopsy revealed that Cook had an enormous bump on the top of his head when he died, which, it has been argued, was far too big to have been caused by the blow from the broomstick, as Franklin claimed. They further openly wondered why, if Franklin was so frightened for her life after she shot Cook, she would opt to drop her gun, still loaded with 5 rounds, and pick up a broomstick to finish the job. Given this, Cook's supporters posited the theory that Boyer targeted Cook at Martoni's. He was drunk, famous, and waving around $5,000 in cash. It's hard to imagine such good fortune. And he was also willing. Boyer was gorgeous, and Cook had a well-deserved reputation as a serial philanderer. And so, each with their own motivation, Boyer and Cook climbed into Cook's Ferrari and drove to PJ's nightclub. And when they couldn't get in, the theory goes, Boyer suggested they drive to the Hacienda, a place she knew well. This is really the heart of the matter, Derek. Why did they go to the Hacienda? Initially, she told cops that it was Cook who proposed the location. Cook drove her there. She didn't want to be with him. It was against her wishes. It comes out later that Boyer had been there before. She's a prostitute, and she sometimes would bring men back to this hotel. It's also a long way from where they were. Cook is fabulously wealthy.
And he's not from L.A., so the story sort of falls apart. This may be a local spot that prostitutes know about, but Sam Cook doesn't.
He has been to L.A. before, and he, again, from what you read, he had a lot of mistresses, had sex with a lot of different women who were not his wife. Whatever. No judgment passed here. But it's not out of the realm of possibility that he would have had his hookup spot that he brought women because he wanted to avoid the paparazzi,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, you may want to be in a discreet location. You don't want to go to the Ritz.
But the fact, once it came out that Boyer had gone there before with other men previous to Cook, you got to think that it was she who suggested the location and not Sam Cook.
That's right. And pieces of the story start to seem like a setup, like he was targeted. The waving of the money around, that's a lot of money. A $50,000 in today's terms kind of score, you could imagine her cooking together some sort of deal to get him alone and maybe take his money from
him. Yeah, and so this is really where the theory of exactly what happened starts to emerge from Cook's point of view.
That's right. Whatever the rationale, after Cook and Boyer arrived at the Hacienda around 2:30 a.m., they disappeared into the room, and Cook's supporters surmised they got undressed and possibly had sex. It was then that Boyer is suspected to have either clocked Cook over the head with something heavy, which would explain that enormous bump on his head in the autopsy, or at least waited until Cook was asleep and made her move. Boyer then grabbed Cook's clothes off the floor with the money inside and made a run for it. She knocked on Franklin's door so she could give her the money to hold, but before she could get inside, Cook opened the door to come after her. Boyer then fled and stashed the money somewhere before discarding Cook's clothes and calling the police to falsely report that she'd been the victim of a horrible crime. But these theories and the evidence that support them took time to develop, and in the meantime, the LAPD was looking to close the case. Let's not forget the time and place we're in. This is 1964 in South LA at a black-owned motel in a tough part of town involving a black victim, a black assailant, and a black sex worker at the center of it all. The investigation was cursory at best, and the matter was very quickly put to rest. Franklin's actions were deemed by investigators to be justified self-defense. Cook's family and friends were outraged. His wife demanded the FBI open an investigation, both into the killing and into the LAPD's refusal to pursue the case. The singer, Etta James, who had recently toured with Cook, echoed that request while suggesting that there may have been a larger cover-up at play. She wrote that she saw Cook's body at his funeral and that his head was practically, quote, disconnected from his shoulders. That's how badly he'd been beaten. His hands were broken and crushed. They tried to cover it up with makeup, but I could see massive bruises on his head. No woman with a broomstick could have inflicted that kind of beating against a strong, full-grown man.
Muhammad Ali, who was a very close friend of Cook's, held a press conference in which he said that, quote, if Cook had been Frank Sinatra, the Beatles, or Ricky Nelson, the FBI would have been investigating.
This is interesting. I wanted to pause here. Have you seen the movie One Night in Miami?
No, I have in connection with preparing for this podcast, but it's a lot about this.
Yeah, you know, he ran in those circles. Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, and Sam Cooke were friends, and Jim Brown as well. Yeah. And this is about the conversations they had, one meeting in a hotel. So the 1964 time period when this took place was at the forefront of the civil rights movement. And you can't ignore that when you examine Sam Cooke's murder.
But ultimately, the FBI rejects all of it, Derek, and there's no other law enforcement action has ever been taken. Neither Boyer nor Franklin have ever been charged with a crime. And so it ultimately just ends in a dispute, a mystery perhaps, about what exactly happened to Sam Cooke, or we know what happened to him, but why it happened. I mean, you know, it's a horrible situation, but I want to go back to the idea that you have sort of this, I don't know how much Cook's family wanted to push this forward. Let's not forget where he was found, who he was with, what he was doing at the time. It's not, you know, in today's world, we might forgive somebody this kind of trespass, but back then that would not have been the case.
Let me ask you, what would this story look like if it happened to someone of a similar stature? Sam Cooke was massive. Let's say this happened to Drake in 2014.
Yeah.
There would certainly be a much larger investigation than what transpired.
And this is Muhammad Ali's point. I mean, in Muhammad Ali's case, it was based in race. He said it happened to Frank Sinatra, it would be an investigation. Clearly true, by the way. Drake is now as big as Sinatra was. It would absolutely happen. But Cooke was that big too, and it was really hushed up pretty quickly. And, you know, I guess we'll never quite know exactly what happened, but it seems like we have a pretty good idea, right?
I think so. Let's go ahead and take a break and come back and talk about the legacy of Sam Cooke.
Sam Cooke's legacy looms large in the annals of music history. He is widely credited as the inventor of soul music, who brilliantly weaved together elements of gospel and pop to make him one of the first black artists to attract a significant multiracial audience. Derek, he was a profoundly deep thinker. He had a lot of philosophies he wrote about. He talked about how he approached songwriting. He wrote, unlike most artists, he wrote every single song that he sang. He also wrote a lot of songs for other artists. And at the time he died, he was really getting into more of the songwriting for others, producing for others, and sort of being in control of things.
It's rare to have all those talents in one person. We think of great singers, Aretha Franklin. She didn't write her song.
That's right.
You think of great writers who didn't sing.
Yeah.
But Sam Cooke was everything all in one.
There's a great interview that he did with Dick Clark where he really talked about his philosophy of songwriting, how he came to decide upon the topics he was going to write about, and how he kind of got the lyrics from everybody's real-world experiences.
How many songs have you written?
Dick, I don't know, but I've written just about all I've sang.
Which is several hundred?
Well, I can estimate this way. I've been in the business now, Dick, for about 6 years, and I haven't had a song that wasn't a hit, so I was on the charts, I think, from the time I started until now. I think the secret is really observation, Dick.
What do you mean?
Well, if you observe what's going on and try to figure out how people are thinking and determine the times of your day, I think you can always write something that the people will understand.
His debut single, 1957's You Send Me, spent 3 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 and 6 weeks at number one on the Billboard R&B charts.
Darling, you send me, honest you do, honest you do. Honest you do. Whoa.
Over the next 7 years, Cook was among the most successful and prolific songwriters in the world. He released 11 albums between 58 and 64, which yielded 25 top 40 hits, every one of which he wrote himself. His 1960 song, Wonderful World, is one of the most covered songs of all time, including by Otis Redding, Don McLean, Simon & Garfunkel, Mike Bolton, and dozens of others. Derek, I know you know the song well. You may remember it. It was the song that was played over John Belushi in the great cafeteria scene in Animal House. He's walking through, filling his tray with all sorts of food, and then eating food out of the garbage as well before coming over and sitting down and creating the entire food fight scene.
Yes.
This is a song that is sort of on top of the entire scene.
Yeah, and it was already sort of such a big deal in music. Animal House comes along. It's around 1980. So it's the end of the 70s, and you're hearkening back to, you need a 60s song that sounds just perfect. So you go to Sam Cooke because he has the best voice, it's the most iconic song, and you throw it into your movie.
But this song has been covered so many times and put in so many different soundtracks. I was able to count 13 different movies that this song has been on the soundtrack for. Animal House just being the most famous.
Yeah.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I love you, and I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
According to Cook's biographer, legendary music writer Bruce Eder, Cook's contributions to soul music gave rise to Aretha Franklin, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and Otis Redding, all of whom have credited Cook as being part of the people that inspired them. Eder noted that it wasn't just that Cook invented a new sound, but he perfected it with, quote, an incredible natural singing voice with a smooth, effortless delivery that has never been surpassed.
By 1960, Cook, now immensely successful, began to leverage his popularity. He started his own record label and production company, designed his own tours, and scheduled his own media appearances. And I wanted to pause. This is a great example of someone who wasn't just beholden to a record company. There was a lot of Motown going on, and a lot of artists signed on to Barry Gordy's label, and then later were very upset with Barry Gordy's sort of terms of how he ran sort of the label. Sam Cooke was on his own making smash hits, and that's why he was able to flash around $5,000 that night. He said, quote, if I write it, sing it, produce it, and print it, I get to keep the money for it, and that's fair. The previously apolitical Cook also began to speak out about civil rights issues, often referencing personal experiences with discrimination. He attended rallies and protest marches where he spoke alongside Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, and Jim Brown, each of whom became close friends. His music began to change as well, as he became less reliant on the subjects of love and heartbreak that had defined him and made him a star, in favor of more profound and personal stories of suffering, sacrifice, and cultural change. That all culminated in January 1963, following an incident where Cook and his entourage were turned away from a whites-only motel in Louisiana, when he penned A Change Is Gonna Come, which reflected the lives and struggles of African Americans. He was warned by his producer that the song might alienate audiences and would likely not be profitable, but Cook said he didn't care and just hoped the song would make his father proud. The result is simply a masterpiece. A Change Is Gonna Come is widely considered to be one of the greatest and most influential compositions of all time, coming in at number 3 on Rolling Stone's 2021 list of the 500 greatest songs ever written.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Cook's funeral was held on January 2nd, 1965. 5,000 mourners crammed into the Tabernacle Baptist Church on Chicago's South Side, which had a capacity of just 1,500. Another 15,000 people waited outside in 8-degree temperatures to get a glimpse of Cook's body in an open casket. Cook was eulogized by Ray Charles, Quincy Jones, and childhood friend Lou Rawls, among others, including his friend Muhammad Ali, who described Cook as a man of integrity and courage. Ali said, quote, at a time when it wasn't easy to speak out, Sam used his platform to advocate for change. He sang about love, yes, but he also sang about justice and equality. He used his voice to lift others up, to inspire hope, and to challenge the status quo. Sam was a trailblazer and a pioneer. He broke down barriers and shattered stereotypes. He proved that black artists could and would succeed on their own terms.
It's been too hard.
short limit, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.